Let's review the Mishnah on Daf Lamed Tes Amud Aleph. The Mishnah establishes a contrast between Ones and Mefata. And that breaks down to three different parts. The first part is about Tsar. And the Mishnah establishes that whereas Ones pays for Tsar in addition to Pagam and Boshes, in the case of Mefata, there's no Chiyuv Tsar. And the Gemara is going to pick that up immediately to try to figure out why there's no Tsar in the case of Mefata. The second distinction or contrast between Ones and Mefata is that the Ones has to pay unconditionally the Knas, whereas the Mefata, it's all conditional. If the marriage will go through, which means that there's an agreement between the Mefata himself and the Nara and the father, then there's no Knas. But if there is no absolute agreement, any of the three parties backs out and blocks the Nisuin, then he pays the Knas. That's not the case in Ones. Ones automatically pays the Knas, and even though the Torah requires of him to marry her. The third contrast between Ones and Mefata is whether or not after the marriage there's a possibility of gerushin. In the case of Mefata, he's got an open door policy. He can decide to divorce her at any time. Whereas in the case of Ones, he's going to have to remain married to her because the Torah says lo yuchal shalcha kol yom, if he cannot divorce her. In both cases, here's the common, this is the last part of the Mishnah, the common denominator between both Ones and Mefata is if there's some sort of an Isur between him and her, then the mitzvah of Velosi Elisha does not apply. We're not going to allow a marriage situation here. Let's say, for example, she's a Mamzeres, he's not allowed to marry a Mamzeres. The Torah says, Velosi Elisha Isha Re'uyolo. So yesterday we began the Sugya of Tsar. The Gemara wants to know what exactly is the Tsar and why should there be a difference between Ones and Mefata. So first the Gemara quotes Avud Shmuel, that's the first approach, that Tsar is Chavot al Gavi Karka. Rav Zeir is not happy with this because although it could and would justify the contrast, the distinction between Ones and Mefata, because only in the case of Ones does he throw it down on the ground, not in the case of Mefata, but there's another problem. And that is that the Mishnah establishes an absolute, unconditional chiv to pay tsar in the case of Ones. Well, Chavot al Gabi Karka, which is an extraneous to the Bia itself, it's not inherent in the Bia, is an iffy situation. To dramatize this, Rabbi Zeir says, what if he throws it down on Shirayim, on some soft substance, like a mattress, or in the case of Shirayim, some sort of big day meshi? So we're going to say it's potur. Now, you could argue, the Gemara says, that maybe the Mishnah is not giving an absolute statement that in all situations, all cases, the Ma'anes pays for Tsar. Maybe it depends on whether Chavot al Gabi Karka, there's no Chavot al Gabi Karka, but then we're going to be stuck with Rav Shimon. So Gemara asks, "V'chitema hafinami," and the Gemara quotes Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon says that Ones does not pay tzar. What's the logic of Rabbi Shimon? And that's where we turn to Daf Lamentes on the days, and that's called Sofol Itztayr Tachas Bayil. So we're going to try to understand what that means. Sofol Itztayr Tachas Bayil. But in any event, whatever it means, one thing we certainly could derive from Rav Shimon, that the discussion of Tsar here in our Mishnah could not be addressing the case of Chavota al Gavi Karka. There's no way that Rav Shimon could deny that the Ones would have to pay for Tsar in this case of Chavota al Gavi Karka. There's no such thing as Sofol Itztayr Tachas Bayil. There's no mitigating circumstance here or consideration that at the end of the day she's going to suffer this Chavot al Gavi Karka. That's for sure not a Havami. If there's something that's inherent in the Bia, and that's what the Tsar is, then you could say some sort of Svara that All he's doing is he's preempting the tsar that eventually is inevitable, and she will suffer that tsar anyway. And therefore, Rabbi Shimon would hold that if you bring tsar to someone that is inevitable, you're just being mocked with this ma'uchar, then you don't pay tsar. That doesn't come under tashlumi mezik. But to say that chavot agabi karka is considered sofa, it's considered inevitable, that whenever she gets married, kidasu kidin, she'll be nechvetal gabi karka, it couldn't be that that's the subject of the Mishnah of tsar. It must be something that's inherent in the bia itself. Now, with regard to Rav Shimon's svara of sofa litzara gabi baila, first we should point out that the Chachamim rejected. Amrulo, they said to him as follows: what do you mean it's sofa litzara tachas baila? Ain't a doma nivellus be honest, le nivellus be rotza. Whatever suffering she will endure as a result of this bia, you can't say that she's going to suffer the same in the future when she gets married, because we're talking about a case of onus. Rav Shimon says that the ma'anes does not have to pay tsar in the case of onus. What are you going to tell me? That a situation where a woman complies and gives herself over to bia, she's going to have this tsar? That's not so. Whatever the tsar of bia is, there's got to be some sort of a balance here between the fact that she wants to have bia, and it's fully, you know, with her will, and a case where she's forced to have bia. When a person, I think this is what the Chacham was saying, when a person gives himself over to a situation where he knows there's going to be some element of tsar, but on the other hand, he wants to have that experience, that pleasure in life, that's a whole different story. When you force a person into a situation, then that's a tsar. So we're going to try to understand as we go along Rabbi Shimon's understanding of sofal itztar tachas baila. But one thing is clear cut, and that's what we have to know right now, that the tsar in our Mishnah could not be referring to chavat al gabi karka, because then Rabbi Shimon makes no sense. There's no such thing as sofal itztar tachas baila in terms of chavat al gabi karka. So what we have to find now is some sort of tsar that's inherent in the bia. And you can argue, and that's Rav Shimon's argument, that eventually she will suffer that tsar. Or you can take the Rabbanan's position that there's a difference between ones and ratzon. So what could be the tsar in the bia itself? And here the Gemara offers two different approaches. The first approach is that of Rav Nachman Omer Rabba Bar Avua, and that's called tsar shel pisu karaglayim, meaning even before the bia itself, in the preparatory stage, there's a certain element of tsar. And you can begin to understand, that Rabbi Shimon's argument is that she's sofal itztar tachas baila, because whatever preparatory stage causes her pain before the bia itself, that's something that she's going to experience even if she willingly has a marriage relationship with an intimacy. That's something that is necessary as a precondition for bia. Now, the reason why the Gemara calls this tsar is because the Gemara wants to separate between tchila and bia itself. Tchila is called the preparatory stage without hanos tashmish. Every tashmish has an element of hanoah in it, and that element of hanoah, of pleasure, can in some sense neutralize the pain that she's suffering. You sort of combine two experiences simultaneously and one beats out the other. It's like kol yom gomer. The one that beats out the other is the pleasure principle. So even though the pleasure may involve some amount of pain, then it doesn't matter. The pain is kind of bottled, it's overshadowed by the pleasure. But that's only if there's simultaneity, meaning if at the time of the pain she's involved in hanas tashmish. But in the case of pisuk reglayim, the hanas tashmish is coming down the line, but it's not yet there. The Gemara now quotes a pasuk Yecheskel Navi to prove that there is such a thing as tsar of pisuk reglayim, and that's because of the mashal that Yecheskel Navi gives to the Ovdei Avodah Zarah when he's castigating the Jewish people for worshipping other gods. He says to them that there's a situation here where they're open to accept any deity. You know, whatever Avodah Zarah is in mode or in vogue or comes along as an opportunity, they jump on the bandwagon. And where do you find a situation of someone who gets involved in non-kosher activities and they're willing to do it, you know, without any hesitation, without any inhibition, wantonly, any opportunity that comes along, they'll jump onto the bandwagon. So that's the case of Vatefaski esraglayich lechol over, meaning you spread your legs for anyone who passes by. This is the mashal. The Isha Zona, who lechol over means she situates herself at the Eimat Drachim, and you know that's where there's let's say two pathways, you know, and they split. So there's a meeting ground in the middle, and that's where, you know, it's like today you have gasoline stations. You know, you'll find that they very often the gasoline station is right off the road when you get off the road. So you can either go this way, continue on the road, or go that way. There's sort of like a meeting point, and that's the location which is Lechol Over, and that's where she situates herself. Comes along Yecheskel, and he says the following: look what she's doing. She is going to suffer Vatefaski Esreglayach, the suffering, the tsar of Pisuk Reglayim, and yet she's willing to do that.
Well, I don't see any indication that this is necessarily a tsar. By the way, it depends on how wide she has to spread them.
Well, you have to understand the logic of Yecheskel. Yecheskel is saying that your situation is such that you are so eager and open to take any opportunity to enjoy the benefits of Avodah Zarah, whatever those benefits are. I'm going to compare you to a person who, instead of making calculations and would say, "Well, you know what? There's a certain element of suffering here. I'm motivated to get involved in this terrible action, and I'm going to overlook that suffering." That's the whole point of Yecheskel. That the Zona becomes a paradigm of someone who has no chash, that nothing inhibits her. She's out there to be Mazana, and any passes by, she's going to do so. And to show you exactly how far she's willing to go, he says, Vatefaski es raglayim, that you are willing to suffer this tsar of pisuk raglayim. So I'll just read you one line from the Ritvo, which is quoted here in the Masifti. It says, "Hanavi mochiach es Yisrael, the castigation of Yisrael, shem zonim achrei avodah zarah." There's like a znus relationship. They're willing to give up their loyalty to God for the sake of any deity that just presents itself as an opportunity. Kamo isha zona, that she also is willing to give up on any sort of loyalty to anyone, just to have this illicit act with anyone who's possibly available, any over derech, even though, says the Ritva, eino choshesh l'tzar shel pisuk reglayim. So that becomes like an extreme example of someone who is so, you know, he's so gravitated towards that goal of having this act done that they'll overlook all the impediments on the way. So the Gemara asks Yehachi, if this be the case. Okay, now wait a second. So where are we up to now? I mean, let's not get caught up with Yecheskel, and again we can study Yecheskel and Navi. But what's more important now is to understand Rav Nachman and his opinion about the Mishnah of Tzar, that in the case of Ones, the woman will sue the Ma'anes for Tzar. We begin to understand the machlokas between Rabbi Shimon and Chacham. Rabbi Shimon's argument in the case of Pisuk Raglayim is a solid argument. We can begin to appreciate it. He says, Sofel Tzartach as Baila. In other words, this stage of Tzar, which preempts the Hadas Tashmish, applies to any woman. Let's say, for example, even after the Onus, so she's now a Ba'ula, she still is going to suffer under her husband with Pisuk Raglayim. And therefore, Rabbi Shimon argues, since this Pisuk Yadayim Raglayim is inevitable, and the Tzar is going to happen down the line no matter what, so with or without the original Onus, she will suffer that Pisuk Raglayim. Therefore, the suffering was not engendered by the Onus. And therefore, there's no chiyuv to pay for that Onus, for that Tzar. That's Rabbi Shimon. The Chachamim counter and say, wait a minute, the eagerness of a woman to have a relationship, that gives her the ability to endure this pain of Pisuk Raglayim. But if she's not willing to have this relationship, then it's pure pain. She's totally focused on pain. Now, I'm not a pain specialist, but there's no question that there are psychological elements that go into pain. You know, no two people suffer exactly the same level of tsar. And also, what are you motivating to do this action? And you're going to suffer tzar. Is it thrust upon you? There are all sorts of different psychological elements here. So the Chachamim are putting the emphasis on the fact that this is a rape situation. She has no thoughts here or focus on Hanas Tashmish, and therefore the tzar is a pure tzar. So that although we made a pretty good argument for Reb Shimon in the sense that there will be tzar anyway, a piece of Gergai down the line, but it's not the same tzar according to the Chachamim. So they therefore say that the Ma'anis has to pay for tzar. But at least we begin to understand Rabbi Shimon. Whereas if we said it was Chavot al Gabi Karka, then Rabbi Shimon makes no sense. You can't say Sofel is Chavit al Gabi Karka. So we must find a tzar that's inherent in the entire enterprise of beer. Now in a minute we're going to have to compare and contrast Onus to Mafata. We've already sort of laid the groundwork for that, because in the case of Mafata, since she's willing to have this relationship, she is not focused on the tzar. You know, there's a trade-off here. And when you're willing to suffer the tzar for some greater goal, it's not such a tzar. You can overcome the tzar. I remember I once had to go right down the block from here to a certain medical examination, which they tell me to do every 10 years. And he wanted to give me this drug that would—it's called tishtush, you know—that would kind of discombobulate me. So the last time I took that same physician, it took me hours to get back to myself. So I said to him on this ground, I said, "Is there any way you could do away with this?" He says, "Well, look, it hurts, you know." So I said, "Look, let's make a deal. If it hurts too much, I'll put up my hand, and then you have to give me the drug." And he agreed to that, and not that I'm a big hero or anything, but I was able to suffer. I got off the table and I went straight back to the base medrash, which is like a 5-minute walk from Skavladach. And why was I able to do this? I have a pretty low pain threshold. I get very sensitive to pain, but I was really focused on a goal. You know, I really wanted to get by this and still have my wits about me. You know. Because last time, like it was 3 hours later, my wife came by. I said to her, "When are they doing the procedure?" This was 3 hours after they had done it. So that's how it works here. Now, there are two points that we want to make here. One is there's a Chacham Tzvi, who was one of the greats about 4.5 centuries ago, who has a whole other interpretation of this sugya. It says the following. How do we understand Sofo Litztayr, Tachas Bailo? V'chi machma sha'asido litztayr, mutu litzara ata v'tzara miyutar? There's no such thing as saying that a chovel v'chavero, who's chayev amongst the various chiyuvim of chavol tzar, that down the line, that tzar is going to happen. You know, right now, you're causing tzar. That's your chiyuv. So what does Rabbi Shimon mean when he says, sofel it's tzar? So first we quote the Pnei Yehoshua, and then we quote the Chacham Tzvi. The Pnei Yehoshua says that according to Rabbi Shimon, this tzar of Pisuk Reglaim Lo Nitan L'Tashlumin Kla. What does that mean? If this tsar is built into an ongoing relationship, meaning every time she'll have intimacy, she's going to have to endure the tsar of Pisuk Reglaim, then that's not something that you could call tsar. If, on the other hand, one thing is going to happen during the course of her life, and she's going to suffer that tsar, that would not be a mitigating circumstance, even according to Rav Shimon. Rav Shimon also said, what's unique about the tsar of Pisuk Reglaim that removes its mufka from Tashlumei Nezikin is because on an ongoing basis, Bechol Tamid Tachas Baila, on an ongoing, continuous basis, she is omedes litzar. It's built into the ongoing intimacy. That's the way that Yoshua wants to reinterpret Rabbi Shimon. So Rabbi Shimon is based on the fact that within the context of an ongoing, continuous, normal marriage relationship, she's going to continuously suffer that tzar. That's not something that you can call tzar. Do you follow what I mean? Like, let's say, for example...
Wait, do you mean Rabbi Nachman or Rabbi Shimon? Because Rabbi Shimon's saying she's got tzar and therefore he doesn't pay tzar.
Says the Pei Yoshua, what do you mean? She's going to have this tzar. And therefore we're not going to bill him for paying tzar. Right? Rabbi Shimon is the one who says that even an onus doesn't pay for tzar. So the more identifies tzar as piece of Reglaim. Says Rabbi Shimon, you know what? Tachas Baila. So what does that mean? Let's say, for example, right now, I had a mosquito bite, right? The mosquito bit me, and I heard. So you can tell me, well, 10 years from now, a mosquito's going to bite me anyway, you know, at some point in my life. You know what I mean? I wake up in my morning and my eyes itch me. So a month from now, you'll also have an allergy attack in you. That's not a mitigating circumstance. That's the Pnei Yeshua's problem. And the Pnei Yeshua says that we have to reinterpret Rav Shimon. Rav Shimon is saying that the reason why Pisuk Reglaim is not considered tzar is a halachic reason. And that means that if the tsar is built into the marriage relationship continuously, that's the emphasis of the word tamid, then that's not called tsar. Tsar is not something that by definition, it's going to happen on an ongoing basis because of the nature of marriage. It's part of the Isha's relationship. But the Chacham Tzvi, who came way before the Bnei Yeshua, was not happy with this. He holds that tsar shel pisuk reglaim shayach rak bebila rishona bilvad. In other words, that according to the Chacham Tzvi's understanding of Pisuk Reglaim, it's a one-time thing. It's the first bia. Only in the first bia does she suffer this, because I guess her muscles, her thigh muscles have never had this experience before.
Wait, is he talking about bringing the hymen or the actual?
I don't think we're up to that yet. That's going to come later on. I mean, you'll have to hold on for that. Move on to Pashtus. I just want to read the words of the Chacham Tzvi. Mishum kach, sha'isha mitzta'eretz b'tzar pisik yadayim, pisik reglaim, pam achas b'meshach hayeva. This is a suffering of reglaim, of pisik reglaim, which is one time in a lifetime. Ulekach, therefore, Ein olav chovas tashlu mishum shebalaf ach yasidu itztar pam achas bekach tachas bailo. In other words, what was the point of the Pnei Yeshua? The Pnei Yeshua is saying that Rabbi Shimon is built on the fact that this tsar is going to be a continuous tsar that's built into the marriage relationship. Every intimacy is going to bring that tsar. Comes along the Chacham Tzvi, so he says, pumfaket, just the opposite. If that be the case, I don't have a problem in understanding why he should pay tzar. And therefore, if Shimon, who says he does not pay tzar, that's not justified. The reason it's justified is because this tzar is built into the first intimacy, the first relationship that she has, and it's inevitable, therefore.
In other words, the rapist saved her from doing it from
exactly. The way exactly. Back. What's going to happen is that when she gets to the marriage relationship, she has spared that tsar, because whatever that tsar only is incurred by the Ilu Rishona.
But then
the Rav Shimon now takes on a whole new meaning. Again, we have two different approaches to Rav Shimon, and again, I don't know the repercussions in other areas in the Zikr. I have a feeling that this is something fundamental. The Pei Yoshua's approach is that if I cause a woman tsar, and that's something that's going to be an ongoing tsar, then the fact that I caused her that tzar, I'm alleviated from any responsibility to pay. The Chacham Tzvi can't tolerate that. Okay, she'll have this tzar during the continuous relationship, during the Meshach Chayim Nisuah, but he added another tzar that was not meant to, that was a vice of tzar, an episode of pain that was not on the agenda. You know, it was not on the schedule. Why should he be paying for that?
But the Chacham Tzvi doesn't work with the pasuk, because the pasuk talks about a woman doing this time after time after time.
Correct, she does it time after time after time, but he's not willing to say that she's always going to suffer this thing. You're right. The Kal Vachomer that we said in the Mashal, that why did Yechezkel in his castigation quote this Mashal of Anisha Zona, is because she constantly suffers this Pisuk Reglaim, and yet she's still going to advance towards her goal, and it doesn't inhibit her. According to the approach of the Chacham Tzvi, it could be that there's always going to be some element, some vestige of tzar here in Pisuk Reglaim. I don't know, but the real Pisuk Reglaim, you know, the one that we're dealing with, that's not this, you know, this superficial, mild. Okay, that's a good word. We're not talking about a mild suffering. We're talking about something profound. Something that's really, really an endurance of pain. And that, he says, is something that a woman suffers from in the first bia. Again, I don't think it means the basula, because that's going to come soon down the line. But I'm just pointing out that if we had time, we would try to break down this Pnei Yeshua Chacham Tzvi Machlokas into a conceptual Machlokas, because I think what the Pnei Yeshua is saying here is that in the light of Rav Shimon, is even though the Ma'anis, is adding another, you know, check off of Tzar, another episode of Tzar, which was not on the agenda, but nevertheless, we have to look at the nature of the Tzar and compare it to Chavola, meaning, how do we define this Tzar as a Tzar that generates Chiyuvei Chavola, Tashlumei Chavola? And that's where Rav Shimon comes up with a new Svara, a breakthrough Svara, according to the Pnei Yeshua, that qualitatively, you can't define and categorize something as tzar if it's something that's built into the normal, ongoing relationship, time after time. Do you follow? The Chacham Tzvi is looking at the fact that he, the Ma'anis, added an element of tzar, call it 5 points worth of tzar, that was not meant on the agenda. If she'll have 100 beers within the course of a married life, that's 100 times 5 is 500, but now she has 505, so he added a five-point tzar. So the Chacham Tzvi doesn't recognize this concept that a tzar that's built into a relationship does not qualify inherently categorically as tzar as far as chiyuvei tashlumei chavolos. So he didn't buy into that. Tzar is tzar. Did you cause her pain? And certainly you caused her pain. Therefore, the Chacham Tzvi was forced, it was an onus situation for the Chacham Tzvi to come up with a new pshat in Rabbi Shimon. Why is therefore Rabbi Shimon saying that the Ma'anis is alleviated from pain when he adds five units of pain? And the answer is because the whole lifetime is only going to be those 5 units, and it's always going to be something that's directly connected to Be'ila Rishona, so that eventually she would have to have Be'ila Rishona. She's going to suffer those 5 units of pain. Anyway, the Gemara now asks, Ihachi Mefuta Nami. Piece of Raglayim is something that she suffers even as a Mefuta. In other words, why does the Mishnah compare and contrast Onus to Mefata and say that Onus pays for Tzara and Mefuta doesn't pay for Tzara? If this Tzara is inherent in the Bia, then even in the case of Mefuta, she's going to suffer this Tzara. And Rabbosai, what's going to be our answer? Our answer is going to be my mushal before about this Gavladach, that if you do it willingly and you're motivated by a purpose and you consented, then you have a goal in mind that whatever benefits you get outweigh the deficits. And the Gemara now is going to give a few mishalim, a few different similes to demonstrate this concept of enjoying something willingly, even at the expense of suffering.
You know what? Wouldn't it just be simple to say she consented, it's partially her fault?
Well, that's the first approach. Okay, yeah, I was... Oh, okay. You're right, I jumped the gun.
Okay.
You're right. What I'm going to say is the imams. What I mean by the imams, the mothers. The Gemara is going to give a string of quotes from mothers. You know, a mother gives a kind of a wisdom. You know, she has almost adages that pass down from the older generation to the younger generation. So those adages are going to reflect the idea that when you're motivated to achieve a goal, you overlook any sort of tzar. So I'll give you one example of a mashal. Rav Pop is going to give a mashal from someone who chews very hard bread. And if he's hungry enough, even though when he chews the hard bread, he suffers to some extent because it may rip into his palate or press onto his palate. But nevertheless, he needs to get his belly filled. So he's willing to eat the hard bread and overlook the tzar. And the tzar is sort of neutralized by the fact that he's just, you know, gluttonously trying to get this down. Or Rav is going to give a mashal about Hakazas Dam. In the old days, you know, they used to bloodlet. So when you prick it in with the needle, you know, there is a certain sting. But the pleasure of Hakazas Dam, let's say someone's suffering from high blood pressure, and you lower his blood pressure by removing the dam, that pleasure neutralizes and overshadows the pain of that original, you know, sticking in. So we're going to have all these mothers' adages here that are passed down. But you're right. I jumped the gun a little bit, because first, the Gemara is going to quote Rav Nachman again in the name of Rav Bar Avo, and he says the following, that you cannot say that the tzar of Pisuk Yedayim Raglayim is a machayev to pay tashlumin in the case of Mefuta, because she willingly consented. And that becomes a mechila. Mechila means, if I tell you to damage me, well, I'm the Bailim, I'm the Balabas, and therefore I can waive any, you know, any kind of rights that I have to sue you for damages. Marshal of Mefuta, Lamado Redome, Lo Adam Shavu Chaveh, Krashi Rayim Shali, Vipate. A man says to his friend, be mazik me, destroy my clothing, and you won't be chayef. That's called mechila. And a person can be mochel. The Mefuta, since she consented to have this relationship, she was mochel on her tzar. So the Gemara is not happy about this. In the case of Karash Shirayim, it says Shali. Shali means I'm the Bailam, it's my Shirayim. I can't tell you to rip someone else's Shirayim. But in the case of Mefuta, what is she saying? That I give up on this tsar and I don't care about it because I want to have this relationship? The Avuaninu. She's not the Balabas on her own Bia. In other words, the Bia, it belongs to her father. Her father wants to marry her off as a Basula, that's his rights. And if he does, he collects the Kesef Kedushin, etc., etc. Is that's a principle called Binurev Beis Avia, that as long as she's a Nara, she's in the Rishus of her father. So that's why he collects the Knas.
Even though Tzar really applies to her, in other words, the father doesn't lose anything because of her Tzar. But we say because she's a Nara, it goes to him anyway?
Correct. If let's say there was a Chovil Binara and he has to pay Nesek Tzari, he'll have to pay the father because Binurev Beis Avia. So if she comes along and she says, well, I'm Ochelis, you know, I don't mind if you beat me up black and blue. She has no right to be Ochelis. You see, Rabosai, this really touches on the whole issue of what Binurev Beis Avia is all about. What does it mean, the Rishus of the father? Does it mean it really belongs to her, but the Torah was Mezakeh the father? Why? Because she's a Nara. Or do we say no? That during her Naros, everything, all monetary considerations and possibilities of collecting damages, that all belongs to him. Do you follow the lumpus here? That's a very fundamental issue here. It's an issue in Knas, it's an issue in Chavol and Ezekiel in general. Like, for example, you remember we discussed earlier that if, let's say, the rape took place when she was a Nara, but the collection of the money was postponed until after she became a Bulgarian, so we established that in such a case, she herself would collect the Knas. Now, she's collecting the Knas for the Maisa Onus that took place while she was a Nara, the Beis Avia. But the answer is that the father collects the knas as long as she's a nara, because he sort of replaces her or represents her. Once he's out of the picture, then we go back to square one, and she collects the knas because she's the one who suffered from this onus and she deserves the knas. You know, it seems on the contrary that she is in the driver's seat here. The father's only representative. But nevertheless, since he gets the money, as long as she's a nara, she cannot be mochelos. That's the Gemara's objection to Rav Nachman, etc. And this objection was so powerful of an argument that Rav Nachman himself backed off, and now he's going to talk about a different distinction between onus and mafat, and the one that I was mentioning before, that she's motivated by pleasure, and the pleasure principle overrides the pain principle in a case of a consenting action. Now, I'll just read to you a summary of Rashi and the Rishonim here that he brings down in the Sif. He says, "Kol mamon shenara marvicha bin arusa, any money that accrues to a woman during a period of narus, harei hu lavia v'lo liatzma." And that's based on the pasuk, which Gemara is going to touch on later on. Involved the nurel de savia kol shvach nurel lavia. Therefore, she cannot be mochel on the tzar, because that's a domim, that's a tvia, that's mamon, that's coming into revach into her bank account, and now her bank account is totally owned by her father. Ella Omer of Nachman Omer Rav Baravua. I'm going to reset. Pikosha ben Omros. Women who are smart, they understand that mafuta ain't la tzar. In other words, the tzar that she suffers because of pisuk reglayim is not a tzar for a mafuta, because although it predates the actual hanoas tashmish, but nevertheless it's being done for the sake of hanoas tashmish, and therefore it's not called tzar. Now, everything that I've said is based on the Shita Mekubetzes, meaning the Shita Mekubetzes understands that we're still maintaining that the tsar that we're dealing with is Pisuk Raglayim. The Aflamaskada, even in the final presentation here that we see in the name of Rav Nachman, etc., is the Tzara's piece of Raglan. That's the Shittim of the business. And the Pikos, those who are a little bit more mature and insightful amongst the women folk, they understand that the Tzara piece of Raglan is not such a Tzara, it's not really significant enough, because since she knows that immediately after the piece of Raglan she's going to have Anos Tashvish, she's able to overlook and endure that minimal amount of suffering. The Nashim She'enon Pikos, they're not thinking down the line. They're in the immediacy of the moment, and therefore they complain about the Tsar B'Shas Ma'isa. They're not interested in the broader picture of the Hanah that's going to be caught, that's going to be brought about immediately afterwards. That's the Shita Mekubetzes, he quotes the Ra'ah, that's the way we understand our sugya, and the Pikos are setting the record straight that this is not Tsar, because she wants to have the pleasure of Bia, she consented, she had total consent to that, and so forth and so on. However, the Tosfos of Rosh learns that the Gemara is now rescinding and rejecting its original position. And now, according to Tosfos Rosh, the tsar that we're dealing with is hasharas habesulin. It's the removal of the besulin, the bia rishonim. And Gemara holds that in the case of onus, the hanas bia does not overshadow or neutralize that feeling of tsar that she has. So in other words, she's having two things going on simultaneously, exactly at the same time. She's losing her besulin, and she's having this bia. Will she focus on the pain of losing her besulin? The answer is it depends. In a case of onus, the the tsar of Hasaris Absulim Gover al Tchushas Hanos Bia, Hanos Tashmish. But in the case of a futa, Emla Tsar Mahmas Shiyeshla Hanos Tashmish. In other words, the Hanos Tashmish, in the case of a futa, is able to counter and sort of neutralize or subjugate the tsar of Hasaris Absulim. Mashenki, in the case of Onis, you know, there's no real Hanas Tashmish over here. She's not interested in Tashmish. This was a rape situation. And therefore, she's left with the pain of Hasaras Absulim. Now, at this point, the Tosfos Rosh seems to have completely dropped the idea of Pisuk Raglayim, which means that he's not willing to say, well, the Pikchos can convince us that Pisuk Raglayim is not really Tsar. That didn't fly with the Tosfos Rosh. Maybe the Tosfos Rosh belongs to the camp of the Pnei Yehoshua that we mentioned before, that during the entire course of her married life, she's going to have this piece of Raglayim. But be that as it may, for whatever reason, the Tosfos Rosh rejects the middle of the road approach, the natural approach that we took, which is really reflected by the Shiva Gubetzes, that we're talking about Pisuk Raglayim. He just completely ignores Pisuk Raglayim and substitutes the tsar of Hasaras Habesulim for that. Now, in the light of the Tosa Rush, if and this is my own comment here, if we put the Tosa Rush together with the Chacham Tzvi, I think we have a very nice symbiotic relationship, and they integrate, because if you remember the logic of the Chacham Tzvi in justifying Rav Shimon, there's this one-time tsar called Pisuk Raglayim that is totally dependent upon Bia Rishona. And that's why Rav Shimon says Sofel it's tire, because that tsar, she's going to have to suffer at some point anyway. And then the Chacham say, well, there's a difference between Onus and Ratzon and so forth and so on. Look, when he tells the Rosh, we can really go along the same lines. That Rav Shimon is saying that Hasaras Absulim is something that's inevitable, and it's totally connected with Bia Rishona, so that it's just a trade-off here. You know, now that she's given up on, you know, and endured the suffering of Hasaras Absulim as a result of the Onus situation, well, she's going to gain in the long run. The net value here, so to speak, of Tsar is going to be the same. What difference does it make if she has the Tsar of Hasaras Absulim now, or if she has it tomorrow when she has Bila Rishona? It's inevitable that she'll have it. And that's where the Tosa Rosh is saying that the Chacham rejected that, because they said that, you know, she can't focus on the Hanoas Tashmish. So that's the difference between an onus situation and what's going to happen later on when she has a marital relationship and she's still a basula, she consummates that relationship, she can tolerate the Asaras Basula. But the Asaras Basula becomes a pain, a tsar in and of itself, independent of the Tashmish in the case of onus, not in the case of Mefuta. So again, Rabosai, it turns out here that if we add the Tosa Rosh into the equation, we have actually three different possible alternative answers to the definition of tzav in the case of onus. That the Mishnah says that an onus pays tzav. One definition is chavot al gali karka, and that seems to be very harshly rejected. The second approach is pisuk raglayim, and then you get into the whole issue, well, what does Rav Shimon mean about pisuk raglayim, and why is it inevitable? And then the third approach is that of Tosa Rosh that we're talking about Asaras Basulim. V'hoka chazino de isle. In other words, with all due respect to what the Pikchos are telling us, that, you know, because down the line she's going to have Hanos Tashmish, therefore there's no tsar in the first stage, we'll call it, let's say, if we go according to Shidu Betz's piece of Raglayim, V'hoka chazino de isle. In fact, even in the case of Mefuta, she suffers and endures the pain of Tsar Pisuk Raglayim. So the Gemara hasn't yet formulated that psychological principle of a trade-off, that you overlook the Tsar for the ultimate pleasure. Om Rabbi, Om Li Aim, I have an adage, a wisdom that was transmitted to me by my mother. Now the truth is, this is impossible, because the Gemara says in Kedushin that Nebuchadnezzar's mother died during childbirth. But the aim here is what's called an omenis. In other words, they appointed a nursing woman who raised Abaye. He was an orphan from birth. His father died, but while he was in an embryonic stage.
That's why he called Abaye, right? Because he's an orphan.
Abaye means nachameni. That the word Abaye means a nechama. I need either I need a nechama or I have a nechama. I have some sort of consolation. And the Gemara actually says, I don't want to go into this, the whole discussion, that Abaye boasted that he was lucky that he was born without parents. Because Abaye claims there's no way you can be mechabed your parents with, according to the Torah.
Well, I think I saw came across that. Where is that?
That's in Kiddush Lamed Beis, I think, or Lamed Aleph, in the famous Sugya of Kibud Av. So anyway, Amali Aim, what was the wisdom that I got from my mother? Kemaya Chamima Al Reishi Dekarcha. Now, what happens is the following. When a person bathes in warm water, that's a pleasure. But this man is karcha, Miloshin Kereach. He's bald. So when you pour hot water on the head of someone who's bald, obviously he doesn't have the hair, you know, to absorb the heat. It's a little bit painful, but nevertheless, overall, it's a timing because there's a certain pleasure involved in bathing in hot water. So the mafuta, Haranos Tashmish, overwhelms or overpowers her tsar of piece of good wine. Rav Amar, he had another adage that he got from his wife. Now it's very interesting. Normally when a husband quotes a wife, he says, "This is what my wife told me," but he doesn't exactly say it that way. Amali Basra of Chizda, the daughter of Chizda, his shver was of Chizda. And he says, you know, instead of saying my wife, he says the daughter, it could be he wanted to be able, you know, he wanted to be refined about it. You know, we're touching on such sensitive areas of sexuality, so he didn't want to quote his wife, you know, to talk about, you know, what is this pain of piece of good wine like.
I don't know, it sounds to me worse when you say some woman told me. Yeah.
Well, not some woman, but he's saying a very chosh of a woman.
I see.
She's a bas talmid chacham. Now, another way of understanding is, that just simply forget about what I said, is that Rava really looked at his wife as the daughter of Chizda. Again, I'm not sure if that's, you know, if that's healthy marriage relationship or not. Mm-hmm. But for the balance of his marriage, Rava died at a very young age. I think he was 40 when he died, but as long as he was married to her, he always saw her as Basra of Chizda. You know, Chazal say it's a great milah if you marry the daughter of a Talmid Chacham. So he always put her on a pedestal. And again, the daughter of a Talmid Chacham has a double plus to her. Number one, you know, she has yichus, and number two, she was brought up with the Torah, and she absorbed what she got in her father's house. But anyway, what did I learn from my wife? Ki rivda de kusilya. So that's what we said before, when you bloodlet, there's a certain little bit of a pain in the pricking of the thing, and when the needle goes in, but you're saying to yourself, wow, you know, I feel so relieved when the blood goes out. And Rapavu Amali Bas Abba Sura. He was married to the daughter of Abba Sura. Sura means he came from a place called Sura. So his father's name was Abba. And the daughter of Abba used to tell me that Tsar piece of the client is like Nahamad Akshufa de Chinche. Chinche is the Chech, meaning the palate. And just like when you eat a hard piece of bread, it's going to irritate your palate. But nevertheless, you don't feel that pain because you're so eagerly, goal-oriented, you know, of getting that piece of bread down your belly because you're absolutely starving, that you overlook that.
These three things are talking specifically about Pisuk V'Glayim?
Well, again, it depends on the Machlokes, Shidim Gubetz, and Tosaf Rosh. Now, if we have to start from scratch with the Tosaf Rosh, so we're talking about Hasaras HaBesulin, so then you're going to have to, again, reinterpret this, all these Mishalim want to tell you that even though the Asaras Pesulim is painful, but in the case of Mafuta, where there's a pleasure, you know, pleasure motivated, then the Tsar of Asaras Pesulim is not, it doesn't register on the Richter scale. Now we go back to our Mishnah. We don't have too much time, but at least there's an introduction. And the Mishnah says that ha'ones nosei miyad ha'mafata l'chiyotzi. Now, literally, l'chiyotzi means when he divorces her. So Gemara says l'chiyotzi, ishtohi. Obviously, the mafata, right? The mafata married this woman, Why is he divorcing her? I mean, basically, the Gemara is saying he's not a shah. If he's going to marry her, and that be the case, then why should he pay the knas when he divorces her? You know, he's parted from the knas the very moment he decides to marry her. And in the context of the marriage relationship, we exempt him from paying the knas. So why does the Mishnah say the mafata l'chsheyotzi? If on the other hand we're talking about before the marriage, and then he decides that, you know, he will marry or he won't marry her, that's not called l'chsheyotzi. L'chsheyotzi means they already were married. But if he hasn't married her, he just decided not to marry her, you wouldn't call that l'chsheyotzi. I just had a deja vu, and I don't know why. I don't think I ever taught this Gemara in my life, but maybe I did, and I don't remember. My mom's just had a deja vu. Anyway, Amar Abaye, Ema l'chshelo yichnos. We have to rewrite the text over here. When the Mishnah says l'chsheyotzi, it doesn't mean when he divorces her, but it means he pays the knas when he decides or declares, I'm not interested in marrying her. So he has two options. He can either marry her and exempt himself from knas, or if he refuses to marry her, assuming that, let's say, both the father and she agree to the marriage, but he backs out, so in such a case he pays knas. But if he marries her, then he's parted from knas. And this is all based on the pasuk, Ima'en Ima'en Avil L'sita Lo, Kesef Yishkol Kemar Avasul, that if there was an objection, a veto, to this marriage, then he pays Kemar Avasul, which is the Chamishim Shkolim of Knas. So the payment of Knas is conditional. It's conditional on the fact that he does not marry her. And why doesn't he marry her? Because any one of three people, and this is going to be the next sugya, have veto power. And they can decide that this marriage is not going to happen. Now I have here a note about Ishtokvar, and he says that there is a possibility of what's called Pitui L'Shem Ishus, which means that perhaps the Mafata was not just interested purely in pleasure, but he was also interested in marrying this woman. And Tosa says that even though his goal, his agenda was to marry her, nevertheless, she doesn't need a get. Why? Because the formal regulations and mechanics that govern Kiddushin are not just that you're interested in marrying her. You need to set up this bia as a bia l'shem ishus, which means that he has to say Arayat Mekudeshesli, and there have to be two witnesses. None of that existed. So even though his motivation, his goal, is to marry her, nevertheless, L'chsheyotzi is not the appropriate language. However, the Ravid says that the Gemara is bothered by the Lashna Mishnah. It would seem from the language of the Mishnah that even after he marries her and he decides that he wants to divorce her, he should be paying the knas. I'll get back to that in just a second. That's a radical position. So the Gemara asks L'chsheyotzi, Hare shenimtzeis ishto mikvar v'nifter miknas. Meaning, how can you tell me that when he divorces her, he should pay the knas? L'chsheyotzi should pay the knas. He married her, and if he married her, he was parted from the knas. And if he doesn't have to pay the knas, he should pay a ksuba. Again, in this case, he pays a ksuba of mana because she's already in Ba'ula if he decides to marry her. But when he divorces her, there's no reason to impose a chiyuv knas on her. So the Gemara and the Havamim actually understood that l'chsheyotzi, he will pay the knas. Why? Because although he opted to marry her, which exempts him from knas, but nevertheless now he's divorcing her. She's basically undoing the marriage relationship as it started, as it began, therefore he should be paying knas. The Gemara says, no, l'chsheyotzi, if they had a marriage relationship, he was parted from knas, and there's no reason to impose a fine on him. Again, he may have to pay ksuba, but knas, that's totally impossible. And therefore, we accept Abaye l'chshelo yichnos, that what the Mishnah means is if he decides, or the father decides, that there won't be a marriage relationship, then, and only then, does he pay knas. The Ma'anes irrelevant. There are two separate chiyuvim. Number one, he has to pay the knas, that's unconditional, and number two, he has to marry. Tani nami hofi, afo pisha omra mafate, no sein, lichshaloyich knas, but that's only lichshaloyich knas. Okay, now we're going to get into a discussion about boshes of gam, so that's going to be for tomorrow, so we're going to stop here at tani nami hofi. And believe me, we'll pick that up tomorrow. Tomorrow, we actually might get to Daf Mem. I don't know. There's a new mission on Daf Mem. So if we get to that mission, it's a nice way of ending the week. We'll see you then.